Welcome, everybody. This is Parshas Beshalach today, and I realize on a day like today how much I miss being here. I wasn't here last Friday, and so I'm going to make some comments about Parshas Bo as well, if you don't mind, just for the continuity. But I feel like one step backwards, because I missed that week, and being with you all, and I hope to, with Hashem's help, and you will get back into it. It's nice to see everybody here. It's a really nice, special time that we have together every week. So I'd like to kind of incorporate some aspects of Parshas Bo and Beshalach to just to repeat the orientation that we have for this week, for this year, as we go through the Parshios. I'm not basing my comments on any particular commentary, but rather trying to integrate and bring together many of the sources, many of the ideas that I have learned and shared, much of it in this forum, in our weekly class. And I've had a lot of insight from various teachers and other sefarim, other scholarly works, that has given really a sense of cohesiveness about the messages of the Torah. Right now, the most recent thing that I've shared with you is the idea of Hashem revealing the truth of his existence, of his oneness to us, first in a revealed manner, and then giving us the tools to be able to find him on our own. This is the meaning of the revelation and the exile, the back and forth, which a pattern which will be repeated throughout the Torah and throughout our history. The most powerful tool that Hashem gives us in order to find him and infuse our lives and our existence with the intended purpose and meaning for which we were created is the idea of the mitzvahs, of the commandments which we are given to perform. Indeed, Parshas Bo is the introduction of mitzvahs. Last week's Parsha, besides being the Parsha in which the Jewish people left Egypt, it was also the introduction of the Jewish people to the mitzvos. In fact, there is a well-known commentary of Rashi. Normally I say, what does well-known mean? It means that I heard of it. But here, this is well-known because it is the very, very first comment of Rashi in the Torah. And in that first Rashi, back on page 2, but I'll just quote it for you, said Rabbi Yitzchak, the Torah should have really begun from chapter 12 in Exodus. Chapter 12 in Exodus is part of Parshas Bo. And Rashi is quoting Rabbi Yitzchak from the sages, who is saying, really, the first book of the Torah, Bereishis, and the first two Parshios, two and a half Parshios of Shemos, really could have been left out. Because the real beginning of the Torah is, Hashem said to Moshe and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be for you the beginning of the months. It shall be for you the first of the months of the year, which is understood by the sages to be a mitzvah in and of itself, that of establishing a calendar, a lunar calendar with which to set the schedule of the holidays. And then, the first holiday being Pesach, because God approached Moshe in the springtime, month of Nisan, right before the Exodus, the first holiday is going to be observed by the offering of the Pesach lamb. And starting from chapter 12, the Torah takes on a much different style than it had up until now. Up until now, it was, if you'll pardon the expression, Bible stories. stories of Abraham and Isaac and Joseph and his technicolor dream coat and Moses in the bulrushes and all those near and dear stories. But you get into Parshas Bo and all of a sudden it becomes instructions, commandments, details.
That's a story.
That's a story too. The plagues are also a favorite story. But in Parshas Bo, we now, on the 10th of this month, they shall take for themselves a lamb or a kid for each father's house. If the household is too small, then they should combine with another family. The lamb should be unblemished. It should be within the first year. You should examine it on the 14th day of the month. They should slaughter it in the afternoon. They should take its blood, place it on the doorpost. This isn't story time anymore. This is mitzvah. And so I really wanted to pause here. And if Rashi says that this is really the beginning of the Torah in the sense of mitzvahs, then obviously one of the most important purposes and messages of the Torah is doing the mitzvahs. So I want to stop right here and say, okay, what do we know about mitzvahs? What is the meaning of mitzvahs? What does it mean for us? How do we go about learning about them and implementing them? Because that is, Rashi is saying, that is really the main focus of the Torah. So, going on the path of integration, this gives us a pause to stop and integrate. What do we know about mitzvahs? So I want to share with you a few ideas. I recently discovered an email that I received, which I've been getting for the last few months, but I haven't looked at them yet. I happened to look at them this week, and they were some essays written by a rabbi, I believe, in New York. And I looked at it and I said, he's talking about our subject. He's talking about mitzvahs. He's actually talking about people who did not grow up doing mitzvahs, but are starting to grow in the mitzvah observance in various stages in their life. So I'm going to share with you some of the ideas which I think clarify to us a little bit why this is why we are a people of mitzvahs, a people of commandments. The first thing to do, and I believe his name is Rabbi Meisels. He doesn't write his name at the beginning, but it seems to be who it's coming from. The first thing to do is identify the importance of engaging in mitzvah performance, in addition to the obvious explanation that Hashem commanded us to do so. You see, many people grew up, some of the senior members can attest that when you were asked, why do we do this? Why, if you were in shul or you saw something and you said, why do we do this? What was the answer that you were given?
It's the law.
Hashem said we have to do it. How many people grew up getting that answer as a standard answer for questions? And unfortunately, not everybody liked that answer. Because although it's true, it doesn't give someone too much to hold on to intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, that is going to propel them and inspire them to fulfill these commandments, which are difficult. So the first thing we have to do is identify the importance, besides the obvious explanation that this is what Hashem commanded. Many reasons can be given. But the one that I prefer is the idea that it is a means of building a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, with the Holy One, blessed be He. Not something we do to please a despotic deity in heaven, which is actually an idea that has its root in pagan thought, where you would give, give sacrifices because to placate them. Not that idea, not that God needs it for His own self-gratification, but because we are building a relationship. Yes, I said a relationship with Hashem. This relationship is no different than the one between a husband and a wife. That is why Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, is described by the Midrash as a marriage between Hashem and the Jewish people. Further proof of this lies in the first Parsha of Shema, where we are instructed to love Hashem with all our heart, our soul, and our possessions. There's supposed to be a love relationship. Relationships, as we know, are built on a combination of positive thoughts and deeds. A relationship that contains only one of these ingredients cannot possibly be considered a meaningful and healthy relationship. A husband who regularly expressed his deep sentiments for his spouse, but never bought her a gift in all their years of marriage, will be considered inadequate by even the most understanding wife. A wife who knows that her husband enjoys certain recipes and professes a sincere desire to prepare them for him, but never actually does so, will certainly disappoint him as well. Assuming that she's a good cook. But then again, maybe she never knows because she never tried. So there is no question that Hashem, too, desires that we experience a closeness of heart toward him. Like all relationships, however, that is simply not enough if we wish to be taken seriously. We must couple the good intentions with meaningful action if we wish the relationship to grow. Action, in this case, is the performance of mitzvos, an array of actions and deeds that Hashem finds pleasing. Moreover, just as in a marriage, there is a time for sentiments and a time for action, the same is true for our relationship with Hashem. It is only on this physical world that the soul can actually follow through on positive thoughts and meaningful action. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and it is not one to be missed. Utilizing the analogy of relationship, I stress to my students that in order for them to truly develop a relationship with Hashem, they must invest in it by performing certain actions that are pleasing to the one above. What's more, unlike in a marriage where sometimes you're not really sure which are the right actions, you might try one thing, you might get a different kind of reaction. But it's not hard to figure out what types of things Hashem likes. He's made it very clear to us exactly which activities will foster the relationship and which will inhibit it. So the first idea is that the reason why mitzvos are so important is because it defines a relationship. It makes the relationship one that is not just words, not just thoughts, but there's an investment in deeds. If we don't invest in the relationship, our actions, our hands on, roll up our sleeves, then it is not a serious enough relationship. Another idea about mitzvahs, get up my notes here, is that it is only through mitzvah observance that we can actually affect our thoughts. There is an expression which many people have used in recent times. I'm a Jew at heart. I don't have to do all the mitzvahs because I know I'm a good person. How many people have heard that expression or that idea? So, according to the Sefer HaChinuch, which is a book educating us about the mitzvahs, actually going through every parsha and pulling out which are the actual mitzvahs that contained herein, what does it involve, what is a possible purpose behind, a reason behind the mitzvah, even though we cannot claim to know Hashem's ultimate reason. But Hashem has given us the mind and the heart to be able to understand with our intellect why this mitzvah is important and meaningful. So in this sefer, actually going on one of the mitzvahs of Bo, the laws of the Pesach lamb, he has a very, very important idea which he brings up. This is very, very well known. I'm not the only one that heard of it. It's often taught in schools and lectures that it is only when we engage in, we take the Torah to the level of mitzvah, the level of action, that we start to really influence who we are and how we think. So, according to the Sefer HaChinuch, saying it's good enough to be a Jew at heart is just not so. It ain't so. And let me share with you exactly what he says about this. He says, he was talking about one of the laws. One of the laws, mitzvah number 16, is that when you prepare the paschal lamb, don't break any of the bones. Now, a person might look at this and say, come on, this is ridiculous. Why does it matter to God if we break the bones, if we don't break the bones? So, he says, and this book was written, the author says it was written in the 1500s. He said he was writing it for his son, because his son didn't have anything structured to do on Shabbos afternoon. And so, in order to keep him and his buddies occupied, he wrote a sefer where they would learn the mitzvahs. It's nice to know that in our own Tamima High School, where my daughter is privileged to be a student, Mrs. Feldman, the principal, has, outside of school time, a club called Taryag. Taryag is the mnemonic for 613, where the students are actually learning to memorize the list of the 613 commandments verbatim. She doesn't know all of them, but she says to me, "Would you like to hear, you know, the first 50?" And she'll rattle them off. It's unbelievable. They had this week they had a trip just to celebrate this extracurricular thing that they do. They went to Chattanooga and have a had a lock-in in a gymnastics place. You know where that is?
Mm-hmm.
Did you see them?
No.
Did you know they were there? Okay. So anyways, this is still being studied in many other places as well.
The level of holiness in Chattanooga changed.
You felt it?
They were there Sunday and Monday, right?
Monday, Tuesday? Tuesday, Wednesday?
Tuesday, Wednesday.
Tuesday, Wednesday. Yeah.
Tuesday. That's the day my backpack got returned.
Wow. So, says, now do not think, my son, to seize upon my words and ask. Well, see, before that he says, why did God instruct us not to break the bones? So he says, for it is not a way of honor for royal princes and counselors of the land to scrape the bones and break them like dogs. This is fit only for the hungry poor of the people to do. Therefore, at the beginning of our emergence to become the treasured choice of all the nations, a kingdom of Kohanim, of priests, and a holy nation, and again every year at the same time, Pesach, it is fitting for us to perform deeds which reflect the great degree of excellence to which we rose at that hour. We are supposed to remind ourselves and re-experience that great elation of becoming God's people and leaving Egypt together with one purpose under Him. So that's why he said, don't break the bones. So then comes along the author and says, and you'll say to me, my son, why should the Eternal Lord command us to do all these things in order to commemorate the miracle? Would the matter not have entered our consciousness through one commemoration? In other words, just talk about it. Just tell the story. Tell the story of how we left as free men. That's enough. In other words, it's enough just to feel it, or it's enough just to say it. Why does it have to be commemorated through this action, this technical ritual of the Lamb? Not out of wisdom would you pounce on me about this, writes the Father. It's childish thinking that moves you to say so. So now, my son, if you have understanding, hear this. Incline your ear and hearken. I will teach you of the Torah and the precepts for your benefit. He says a man is influenced according to his actions. His heart and all his thoughts are always drawn after his deeds in which he is occupied, whether they be good or whether they be bad. A person who is wicked in his heart, and every imagination of the thoughts of his heart are evil. But if he will arouse himself and strive to occupy himself in the mitzvos of the Torah, even if it's not for the sake of heaven, even if it's not solely for the pure intention, he will veer at once toward the good. And with the power of his good deeds, he will deaden his evil impulse. For after one's act is the heart drawn. Okay, what he's saying is that it doesn't matter what you're thinking, what you're feeling in your heart. Get yourself, discipline yourself to do the mitzvah, to act according to the ways of the Torah, and your heart will change. Your mind, your thoughts will change, and your evil thoughts will vanish. On the other hand, if you take a person whose heart is upright and honest, desiring Torah and mitzvahs, you know, the one that says, I'm a good Jew at heart, but let that person engage in impure matters. For example, let's say he was forced by a king to do something evil. Let's say he was, for example, in Mitzrayim, to become the executioner. How about in Egypt when Pharaoh took the Jews and said, you're supposed to be the taskmasters over your brethren? Right? So even in their heart of hearts, they certainly feel nothing against their brethren. On the contrary, but if they succumb to this task and they start doing it, guess what's going to happen? They're going to become cruel. They're going to become insensitive and become cruel because their actions dictates the heart, not the other way around. The heart is not stronger than the action. The action is stronger than the heart. And that's his basic principle here. He says, if you ask why we have to engage in these seemingly trivial actions of mitzvahs, that's because that's really the only way to influence ourselves in a certain way. Adam nifal kefi pu'losav, a person through action and symbol that we perform, that is the way our souls move. Yes? Perhaps. Yes, that's very good. You shall do and then you will understand. Very good. Excellent. Which is the way they accepted the Torah. Excellent. So we have now two ideas. One is an idea that in order to be involved in a true relationship, there has to be thought and speech, of course, but there has to be deed. And number two, the way that we are conditioned, we have thoughts and we have feelings. It's only the actions that we actually perform that are going to tip the thoughts of our hearts one way or the other. If we don't perform the deeds, then whatever good intentions we have, whatever meaning, understanding that we think we have in our hearts will dissipate in favor of our deeds. So these ideas speak of the centrality of the necessity of Torah being a life of deed, of action. And indeed, we put so much of an emphasis on study and learning, but that is because, as the sages teach, Gedola Talmud Shemevili Deimasa, learning is so great, so powerful, because it inspires one to action. In other words, the learning is not the end in itself. It is the most powerful experience that we can have because it brings us to the next step, the step of deed, so that we are infused not merely with the understanding of the Torah that we're learning, but it is carried out into deed as well. And that's when it really impacts us. This idea, these ideas, is really leads into another very, very critical question that is very, very at the core of Judaism in our generation. And that is, as I mentioned before, not everybody is brought up on a diet, if you will, of Torah and mitzvahs. There are the vast majority of Jews today are beginners at best. That's right, and there's really no exceptions to that. And the question is, the Torah is vast, 613, I can't even count that high. And you want me to do all of these mitzvahs, and how do I even know how to do it? And I don't even think I could. So our author addresses this in the next few paragraphs, which I think is really the next part of this discussion. Those who grew up in a community such as this are very, very fortunate and blessed with this kind of guidance that they have been receiving for years and decades under the leadership in this community. And so I'm really preaching to the choir here, but it is worthwhile to get the proper perspective, time and again. One of the main beliefs that hold people back from making any level of commitment, however, is the belief that unless they observe all the mitzvos, there is no value to observing even just a few. This is a terrible fallacy, and one that must be put to rest early. You must stress that just as a relationship between two people doesn't and shouldn't mandate the same level of meaningful action in its early stages as a fully developed relationship in an advanced stage, our relationship with Hashem must be started slowly. First, a person accepts the responsibility of one mitzvah, and over time, he assumes another, and then another, until he is ready for a full-blown relationship. No one is expected to assume all the mitzvos in a short span of time, nor is it healthy to attempt to do so. As an analogy, the author illustrates this in his own life, which is the life of many, where a child is grown up, is brought up into a home, into an environment of Torah observance, and probably starting with age 5 or 6. Knows a lot more than some adults, and yet it is not until the age of bar or bas mitzvah when they're actually required to fulfill them. So if that's true, in other words, he says, why don't you have to do mitzvahs as soon as you're old enough to know? The answer is that obviously Hashem understands that this relationship truly requires significant time to develop, even under the most optimal of circumstances. How much more so then when the person attempting to forge that relationship approaches it with a plethora of preconceived notions, many of them hostile. As we mentioned before, many people have, for one reason or another, gotten negative vibes about observance. And there are, of course, personal habits that have been developed, social constraints, and all of these stand in the way of this relationship. Why would Hashem expect that this person assume all mitzvos at once? It is not reasonable to think that Hashem expects every Jew to start doing 613 mitzvos. It's just not reasonable. It's not a real relationship. It would be pretending. It would be acting. Of course he does not expect that of them, nor does he want it from them. What is he looking for then? What does Hashem want from a Jew in terms of their own personal observance? What he's looking for them is to begin observing one or two, in brackets, maximum, mitzvos, and then build on that foundation. In other weeks, the author talks about where's a good place to start and what are certain criteria in deciding which mitzvahs to observe that one isn't already. And one of the things he says is it shouldn't be something that comes in the way of family. It shouldn't be something that a person is likely not to drop after a short amount of time. On the other hand, it shouldn't be something. I was talking to a non-observant Jew, and I said, "Are there any mitzvahs that you would like to take on?" And he said, "Well, we do a mitzvah. My family and I volunteer once a month to go to the soup kitchen." So I said, "But that's not something that you would do because of Torah observance, is it? It's something that you do because you were taught that that's a good deed." And he says, "Yeah." I says, "That's not really taking on a mitzvah, even though it is a mitzvah. But that's not, you know, that's not like a step towards observance." And he agreed. And so we settled upon reading the Shema. Reading the Shema. Which the author, in a different article also, he recommends. He recommends the parts of davening, or he recommends making brachas over food, if the food is kosher. Although I heard of a rabbi who once was approached by somebody and says, "Rabbi, I want to do more mitzvahs." So the rabbi says, "Why don't you make brachas?" He says, "Rabbi, I don't keep kosher." He says, "Okay, so make the brachas over the non-kosher food." Now this, I don't think, is standard halachic ruling. But this is what this rabbi did. So the man said, "You sure I can do that?" He says, "Sure. At least you're doing one mitzvah." So he says, "Okay, Rabbi." Within a few weeks, this man was keeping kosher. Because he says, "Rabbi, I couldn't live with myself making kosher over a ham sandwich. Making a bracha over a... So little by little, this... And that was the thinking of the rabbi, by the way. So it's amazing how people can grow once they start. But that's the key. The key is that one has to enter into this as one would any relationship. You don't rush into things. Anytime you rush into something, it's bound to fail. Anyway, this is crucial information and guidance for our generation. Rabbi Weinberg, Zatzal, also spoke about this a lot. This book that one of his students put together, essays based on Rabbi Weinberg's teachings. He also, I had a bookmark here, but it says, "Go slow. What is the right pace for growth?" And just read to you a little bit here. "We are all good people. We all want to reach our maximum spiritual potential, yet we sometimes move too fast for growth to last. How many of us leave Yom Kippur thinking that we will never gossip again? And then that first violation happens when we aren't thinking and we give up. We have to learn to move more slowly. We have to utilize patience in our spiritual growth. We have to remember that it doesn't matter how high up you are on the spiritual ladder, as long as you are moving up." Okay, that's the picture on the and this is called moving right along. So we can't confuse the message of go slow with the message of move along. You know, We don't want to get stuck in the middle and say, "Well, I'm so slow that I'm not even moving." Right? We have to move. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. If we don't incorporate mitzvahs, it's not a real relationship. But it's got to be something that is right for us. And every person has their own their own pace. Thank you. So that is what I really wanted to address as far as Parshas Bo. This is the beginning of mitzvos. Unfortunately, it's not Parshas Bo anymore, it's Parshas B'Shalach. So I have to say a little bit about Parshas B'Shalach. But this is really the main thought that I wanted to, if we would have left our Parsha class without talking about this key principle, I think we would have been, we would have had a very big gap. So that's really the message of Bo. As far as B'Shalach, well, let me say something very brief. B'Shalach is a Parsha where we experience some of those ups and downs that we spoke about earlier. And this was the Parsha in which the Jewish people, they thought they had seen everything, but they realized that they hadn't. In Egypt, they had seen God's miracles. And there was no question that they were being lifted up and without a doubt that God was behind them. But in a matter of days, they found themselves back in a rut again. And they were in the desert, and they were being chased by Pharaoh. And there was a point in which they thought that their end had arrived. The scene in the Chumash, it's probably one of the most dramatic and the most heart-stopping scenes of the entire Torah, where the Jewish people literally think that they are they're going to die. And the Midrash says that there were actually four different opinions about what to do as they stood there with the sea on one side raging and the approaching Egyptians on the other side. And the Midrash says that some people thought we should just throw ourselves into the sea and commit suicide. And others thought that we should just surrender and go back to Egypt. And others thought we should fight a war. And others thought, we can't fight a war. Let's just make a lot of noise and try to scare them off. And the Maharal explains that these represented various levels of trust and faith in God. I mean, here Moshe had told them that God was going to take them out of Egypt, take them to the promised land. Some people didn't believe that anymore. Some people did believe it, but they thought that there will be casualties. And other people thought that maybe they can make it there, but not unless they fight, not unless they scream. And what Hashem was saying to them, to all these groups, none of the above. You're not going to go back to Egypt. You're not going to die. Not even some of you are going to die. You don't even have to fight. You don't even have to make a peep. You stay here, and I will bring you through to safety. None of the above. One of the lessons from the Parsha B'Shalach of Kriyas Yamsuf, that the more, and we mentioned this a few weeks ago, the more one puts their faith in Hashem above, the more He shows them, I'm really carrying you. You may not know how you're going to get out of a situation. You may not have any idea. You may think in your limited mind it has to be this way or that way. Either we turn ourselves in, or we die. And Hashem, if you put your trust in Hashem, Hashem says, there's a third alternative. You're not going to turn yourself in, and you're not going to die, and you're going to go on to safety. This is the way faith works. Hashem shows us that puts us into a situation where we are cornered. Then we have to rise above it and say, Hashem can do anything. I once heard a story, I'll close with this. A teacher of mine once told me amazing insight into bitachon, into trust, that he heard from the famous Magid of Yerushalayim, Rav Shalom Shvadron, of blessed memory, who was really the inspiration to Rabbi Krohn's series of books. The Magid Speaks. That was the Magid, Rav Shalom Shvadron. So he was once in Baltimore, and he gave the following anecdote. He said, once there was a young man who was a promising Torah, budding Torah scholar, and he was in yeshiva, and he was single. He had his parents, support, and one day he decides that he's leaving the yeshiva and he's going off to the working world. And goes to his Rosh Yeshiva to thank him for all these years of tutelage, but that he's going to be going into the workforce. And the rabbi asks him, you know, what happened? What's going on? He says, well, Rabbi, I'm afraid that if I don't start a career, I won't have enough money to support my family and my children and their education. So he says, oh, how many children do you have? He says, Rabbi knows I'm not even married. He says, well, how do you know you're going to get married? So the boy looks at him and says, Rabbi, what? He says, oh, no, don't worry. I bless you that you should find a lovely wife and you should get married. But how do you know you're going to have any children? So he looks worried again. He says, Rabbi, you think I have something to... Emir Tzashem, God be willing, you should have children, they should be healthy. So he was like perplexed. Why is the rabbi talking this way? So the rabbi says to him, you see, you trust that Hashem will find you a wife. You trust that Hashem will bless you with healthy children. So if he can do all of that, he can also provide you with the means to raise them. The same God that gives you the child will give you the wherewithal to support. And it's a great story, but it gives us very often we trust in Hashem in certain things, but not in others. And the idea of Bishalach and through the manna, how they were fed day by day with their daily needs, and they didn't have a lot. They only got what they needed for that day. A woman in the community was actually raised Christian, and her mother just passed away. And she shared with me, she was talking to people, and she said something that her mother used to say. It was a very, very religious woman, her mother. And her mother used to say, God provides all of our needs. Not all of our greeds, but all of our needs. And that's also a lesson from Bishalach. You don't need to be wealthy. You don't need to be luxurious. We're here for a spiritual reason, but Hashem will make sure that we have what we need. We will have our manna. We won't be lacking, and we will be able to devote ourselves to our spiritual growth and development. But these are such beautiful messages that we learn from Bishalach. So we have with us, I've taken a lot of time about Bo, but in these two parshios, we have such fundamental tenets in Judaism. The first one being the centrality and the importance of mitzvos, of action in forming that relationship with God, and that in the other aspect of the relationship is the trust factor, knowing that Hashem alone is our provider and that He will give us all of our needs if we will just turn to Him. Thank you. Shabbos. Yashar Koach.